In November 2009, Bronnie Ware published a short essay entitled Regrets of the Dying. It was a reflection on the years she worked in palliative care, taking care of people in the final days of their lives. And she'd noticed that the same basic set of profound regrets kept coming up over and over and over again, as those in her charge would lie waiting for the end, often sharing the deepest parts of themselves. That short essay exploded online. It was shared, reprinted, and read millions of times, leading then to an international best-selling book, The Top 5 Regrets of the Dying, along with a frenzy of attention and travel and the start of a new career as a writer. Those regrets have since been discussed and deconstructed many, many times. They're important reminders of what truly matters in life, and we'll talk about them a bit today. But what about Bronnie? What about the woman who actually brought these regrets to our lives? Who was this Australian artist turned banker turned palliative care worker? What led her to do such soulful work in a field that so many others could never imagine embracing? And what were the deeper drivers, her hidden passions, her big dreams, and also profound and dark struggles? And what happened to her after the global phenomenon took hold, shaking her existence in a really powerful way, both for the better and for the worse? And what's she up to now? So I asked Bronnie all of these questions and more when she came to the Good Life Project studios in New York City during a month-long trip from Australia a little while back. The conversation got really deep, really truthful, really quickly, and she is incredibly generous with both her inner thoughts and beautiful lens on life. And I wanted to share this conversation. We aired it a couple of years back now, and it feels like we have been through a year, and it is a time of year where it's a really powerful moment to reflect on who you are, what you're doing, how you're devoting your energies in your life, and how you might want to be intentional about the way you really wake up in the morning and live each moment. Really excited to share this best of episode with you, with my friend and guest, Bronnie Ware. I'm Jonathan Fields, and this is Good Life Project.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Good Life Project is sponsored by the ADHD Aha podcast hosted by Laura Key. So I've been kind of amazed at how many conversations I've had lately with people later in life who are wondering if they have ADHD. It can be hard to understand what ADHD is by looking at a list of symptoms. So in each episode of ADHD Aha, you'll hear heartfelt interviews about the unexpected, emotional, even funny ways that ADHD symptoms surface for adults. Like the recent episode with ADHD coach Emily Weinberg, which really resonated with me. Her story about how she was thinking she was, quote, just lazy before her diagnosis because she wasn't hyperactive really struck a chord. Her feeling frozen and stuck, ruminating on mounting to-do lists is just so relatable for so many people. It's really validating to hear others articulate those experiences. Each episode of ADHD Aha features candid tales of realizing that you or a loved one has ADHD. You'll hear the unexpected, emotional ways that it manifests in adults through heartfelt interviews. ADHD Aha captures the authentic human experience of ADHD. So if you want a fresh, personal perspective that embraces the messiness, listen to ADHD Aha. Search for ADHD Aha in your podcast app. That's ADHD Aha with Aha spelled A-H-A. It's an aha moment you won't miss. I want to take a little step back with you because, of course, you sort of exploded into the world's consciousness when you wrote about these top five regrets of the dying. We'll talk about them a bit, but I'm also really just curious about you as a person and your journey.
Sure.
My understanding, you grew up on a farm in Australia.
Yes.
What part of Australia?
It's called Northwest New South Wales, so the New England area. And it's about halfway between Sydney and Brisbane on the Inland Highway. So Australia is, the east coast of Australia is separated by a mountain range called the Great Dividing Range. And on the right-hand side, on the east side, it's lush rainforest down to the coast. The moment you get onto the west side, it's farming wheat growing country and very dry. And so we're on the west side of the range. And, beautiful area, big mountains and big skies, really huge skies.
You know, yes. It's funny. I have many years ago, I spent about 3 months backpacking and diving down the east coast of Australia.
Oh, fantastic.
I flew into Cairns and we went up to Cape Trib and just slowly worked my way down. And when we hit Brisbane, I went about 3 hours inland to a sheep station and just stayed there for, I think it was probably around a week. And I remember being there and just one night, literally just walking out into the open, lying on my back and staring up and being just gobsmacked, watching the stars literally like drop down to the ground, with no light around.
That's right. And you see stars from horizon to horizon, and it's just phenomenal. I used to do that as a child with my dog, and we'd just go outside of a night and just lie there for hours. Even as a teenager, it's a pretty good way for a teenager to spend their evenings instead of running crazy in the wrong crowds or whatever.
So even out in the country in Australia, they had the wrong crowds.
Oh, sure. They're everywhere.
I mean, tell me a little bit about what it's like growing up there, because it's so foreign to my experience. I grew up in a suburb of New York City.
Well, it was fantastic. From when I was seven, I knew how to drive. I was driving a tractor from when I was seven years old.
No.
And we live so far from the bus stop that all the farm kids surrounding, there are only two farms on our road, and that was about 4 miles long. But all the surrounding farms as well, they're all so far from the bus stop that we all used to drive old unregistered cars and park them at the bus stop. So from when I was 10 or 11 years old, I was driving a car to the bus stop illegally, but everyone was doing it. And at the bus stop, there'd be six or seven old battered cars, and they'd just be left there on the side of the road in a paddock for the day, and then we'd get off the bus and drive home again. And so, you know, it was fantastic. And I always had a horse and could just jump on a horse and ride whenever I wanted to. And, you know, for me, there was always a longing to discover the world beyond that. But at the same time, the way that love of space and the sky has affected my essence, it's quite essential for my balance these days to be able to have some sense of openness. And I'm very grateful for that. But it was a simple upbringing in those ways. It was beautiful. Big sunsets, big sunrises. Yeah.
Yeah, it's funny too, because we're sitting here recording this in my home studio in the smack in the middle of Manhattan.
Yes.
And we were just having a conversation before going on air about, you know, just the almost like mass chronic level of overstimulation that exists in a city like this. And when you come up in a place where there is such stillness and such openness and such space, how does it affect you when you move into a place like this?
It's affected me a lot more than I realised the last few days. I've recently moved to an area that's quite residential, because I want accessibility, but still within 10 minutes drive I can be in cane fields by a river, so it's not extremely residential, but there are neighbours and suburbia and the sound of traffic in the distance. And I didn't think it bothered me that much. We've only been there a few months. But after 4 days so far in Manhattan, I'm just longing for silence, absolute silence. And I'm thinking about my home and thinking, can I actually settle there forever? Because I'm realising how strong that longing for silence is. I thought that my desire for accessibility was stronger than my longing for silence. But after 4 days in Manhattan, I'm starting to think, oh, I just want to be in the bush somewhere. So I think that to live here, you know, thankfully we're staying near Central Park. You have to make that conscious effort to get grounded in nature as regularly as you can. That's the only way you can stay balanced, I think, in this environment. And it offers so much, so many fabulous other things that we're here for a month, and I'm certainly going to embrace it as much as I can. But already in this first week, I've realised how important it's going to be to reconnect with nature as regularly as possible.
Yeah. Yes. I so agree with that. I mean, it's one of the reasons why we picked where we live in the city is because we have both the water and, you know, one of the largest green parks in the world, 2-3 blocks from me. But even with that, we've been working really hard on a bunch of projects on our side. And we literally got in a car 2 weeks ago and we rented a barn out in Woodstock, New York, you know, 2.5 hours out in the country with, you know, a couple acres of land. And we were still working. We weren't taking a vacation, but we just needed to get out of the stimulation of the city, to just, you know, be away for a week, to kind of just, yeah, I think we're feeling it in our bones, in our body, in our nervous system.
Yeah, and I think we have to listen to our bodies with that. We certainly do, because it's they're warning signals. And if we can maintain that sense of balance, then we can really embrace all of the wonderful things cities do offer, but at the same time, not lose ourselves in the process of the madness.
Yeah. Indeed. So, speaking of losing yourself in the process of madness, and tell me if I'm correct here, if I'm missing steps, please feel free to let me know.
Yeah.
You grew up in all this beautiful open space in Australia, and then somehow found your way into the world of banking.
Yes.
Which I had, when I first became aware of you, when I first saw that, I was like, wow, it kind of came out of left field to me.
Yes, well, my dad was a songwriter and an accountant, and in those days...
Okay, wait. I can't just let that go. So you grew up on a farm with a dad who was a songwriter and an accountant.
Yes.
Take me a little bit deeper into this.
And a farmer as well. Started off being a songwriter and a guitarist. He was a very well-known guitarist in the 1950s in the Australian, one of the pioneers of the Australian country music scene. But he also had a great head for numbers, so he was an historian as well, and then became an accountant. And so his main income was through accounting, because initially he was gigging 6 days a week, and then Mum had a whole tribe of kids and she needed him home more regularly. Mm. And so he let go of a lot of his life performing, and then became an accountant and just did songwriting on the side for a lot of the other musicians. And he was also a radio announcer as well. And so we had this very conservative, structured lifestyle in some ways. We had the freedom of the farm, but Dad had a Monday to Friday job. But then on weekends for extended times, we'd get all these what we call hillbillies, country music singers, turning up and camping on our farm for 3 to 6 months.
Oh my God, how amazing must that have been?
Yeah, it was fabulous.
It's like your own mini Woodstock.
Yeah, all the time. As soon as one caravan would go, it'd be only a few months and there'd be someone else staying. And these were some of the most famous people in the country music scene in, say, the 70s. And in those days, they used to just travel Australia in their caravans, and they'd stop for 3 months, write new songs, regroup themselves a bit, and then off they'd go again. That was the lifestyle. And so they'd all come into the house and say, oh, I wrote a great song last night, and Dad would get out his guitar and they'd play, and then he'd interview them on his shows, or he'd play their music on his radio shows. And then they'd disappear. And then we'd just be this family with no music, because Dad was really closed with it when other people weren't around. And so then we'd just be this regular family with an accountant as a father. And then all of a sudden, phew, they'd come back again. It's like, oh, this is fantastic, you know. So I had those influences, those real polarities of the artistic life and the corporate conventional life. And so when I left school, in those days you pretty much got married and had children, or you went to college. And, you know, I finished school in 1984. And so that they were sort of the options. And my intention was to get a job for a year and then go to college. But in that year, I got used to not studying and earning money and moving in a whole different crowd. And so that first year, my job, I just got a job straight from school. I went into a bank in my hometown and I said to them, I want a job in Sydney with your bank. And apparently my determination was, I don't know what it was, that the guy just knew that I'd be okay with it and interviewed me, rang my parents, said, is it okay if we send Bronnie to Sydney for a job? And they said, oh, okay, fine, yeah. And so pretty much 2 weeks after I finished school, I moved to Sydney and lived with my grandmother and started my banking career, and then spent the next 15 years fighting this call to be an artist and a creative person, all because I thought I was meant to be a banker.
Yeah. So what was that deeper call about? Like, did you feel that even from the time you before you made that decision about banking?
The call wasn't that obvious to me at the time. What was obvious was my dissatisfaction in working a Monday to Friday life, and a life where I loved banking in the sense that I love customer service, so I loved people, but I didn't love the sales aspect of selling products. I couldn't care less about. And so there was just this growing discontent and a very painful discontent after years. And so I kept moving from town to town. I became very nomadic, and I think I didn't spend anywhere longer than 2 years in 27 years. So I moved a lot and just ran away from this restlessness until it caught up on me. And yeah, so I think it was just that discontent was my calling. And it wasn't until I started working through that I realized my calling was to write and inspire. And yeah, and thankfully I finally faced the courage to do that. Yeah. Finally. Yes.
What's interesting to me too is that, I mean, we tend to spend so, I think we're so ingrained to follow the expectations of others that even when we know that something's not quite right, and it seems like clearly, I mean, if you just had this enduring sense of restlessness, it's like, it sounds like your approach to trying to resolve it was to, you know, geographically move.
Yes.
Figuring like maybe that's what's actually going on here. But I've had so many conversations with people where we endure some experience of restlessness like that or dissatisfaction for so long. And I often wonder, you know, like, why? Like, why do we so often endure that for such an extended period of time?
I think what happens is we've got to wait until it becomes too painful. We don't allow ourselves to be pulled forward by the thought of pleasure as much as be pushed forward by the feelings of pain. Mm. And, you know, it is so much shaped by the expectations of others. And I knew if I left the banking industry that I'd be up for criticism and strong opinions from people who did influence me in those days, and people in the family and other people. And it took a lot of courage and a lot of pain, you know, to actually realize that the pain was unbearable, so that it was time, no matter how painful the opinions of others were going to be, they were never going to be as painful as my own pain in not being true to my own calling. So I think pain is the bigger catalyst than pleasure. Rather than try and focus on how great it would be to have a job I loved, it took, in my case, and I think in most cases I've come across, it was actually when the pain becomes unbearable that you finally find the courage to make the changes.
Yeah. Yeah. In your story, in your journey, was there a moment of sort of reckoning or awakening, or was it just sort of a slow building and it just, you hit a point where you just said no more?
Oh, there were a lot of moments, but a lot of slow building also. Mm. I think the turning point was one day I was reading Creative Visualization by Shakti Goyen, and I think that's how I pronounce her name.
I think so too, but I don't know for
okay.
sure.
So thank you, Jacques.
At least we're together on that.
Yes, yeah. I was living in Perth in Western Australia at the time, and I was shopping every week. I'd buy a book from a shop called The Inspiration Factory, and I was catching a train back and forth to whatever my banking job was at the time, but it meant that I was reading a lot of books. And so in that book it said make a list of what you're good at and what you like to do, and the only things that really fell in both were creative things like photography and writing, and funnily counting money, but that was more to do with maths. I enjoyed maths, but it was clear that mathematics wasn't actually making me happy because I was doing plenty of counting in banks. And so when I eliminated that, I realized that the only two things that fell in both were writing and photography, that I consider myself good at them, you know, and even admitting that to myself took courage, and I loved doing them both. And it was a turning point because I thought, dare I think I could actually be a creative person? Like, am I one of, you know, do I fit in an artist category here? Hang on, you know, I've just spent all these years in banking and did really well in banking. I actually moved up the ranks quite fast because I changed banks and locations so often. I had this vast experience, and so I was very employable in every new town. So I actually had quite an accelerated career path. And all of a sudden I just thought, you know, I might be an artist. Mm. You know, could I really be an artist? So from then I began collating all my photos and writing quotes with them and selling them at markets. And it took, from that point, it took a couple of years, another year or two, to start selling them at markets. And then, I think it, for another 14 years, then I kept going with that until I actually started making a living as a creative person. But that led me through looking after dying people to fund my creative journey. It led me through being a songwriter, teaching in a women's prison, teaching songwriting in a women's prison, and becoming an author. So that was a long journey as well. But I think all of it was possibly, that was probably the main turning point, was acknowledging that I'm actually an artist, not a corporate person.
Mm. Mm. I mean, it's so interesting too, because you were brought up in a house with a dad who was essentially this role model of living both lives.
Mm.
But at the same time, I guess you, the way you described it, you also saw him essentially give up the pure artistic life in the name of, you know, the 9-to-5, the business life, as soon as it was time to, you know, quote, be a grown up and take care of the family, with the exception of these artists who would pass through for a window of time and then
yes.
kind of vanish into the ether. But that it seems like that still wasn't enough to sort of like allow you the internal permission to say, well, I could actually step into this full time. It took quite a journey.
You're spot on there, because he didn't give himself that permission to
enjoy it. Was almost like it was almost like the opposite.
Yeah. And so for me to do that, it was basically going against everything, all of the examples that had been set for me growing up. And it was new territory. It was shattering the family mold, and all my siblings were in corporate roles as well. There were no artists in the family, despite all of that dad was an artist and a fabulous one. You know, he just denied himself that pleasure. Yeah, you're right. I did have to break those molds, and it was hard work.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary. Not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
Good Life Project is sponsored by Quince. So my wife actually originally introduced me to Quince because she loves their clothing, and I have been hooked ever since. I literally lived in their Mongolian cashmere ribbed beanie and pullover hoodie pretty much all winter. And as the weather warms up, I wanted more breathable summer pieces without overpaying. And Quince has just the super high quality items like linen shirts, performance polos, activewear at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Quince partners directly with top factories, cutting out the middleman to pass savings to customers. Actually just ordered a new European linen long sleeve button down shirt. Super excited to get that. And I'm always just so amazed at how they can keep their prices so affordable while the quality remains really high. So if you're looking to upgrade your wardrobe, I highly recommend you try Quince. Go to quince.com/GLP for free shipping on your order and a 365-day return. That's quince.com/GLP to get free shipping and 365-day returns. quince.com/GLP or just click the link in the show notes. Trust me, your wardrobe will thank you. Good Life Project is sponsored by Lumi. So listen, we have all had those awkward moments where a BO strikes at the worst possible time. I'm often actually out in nature when I'm exercising, so I don't even notice it when I'm out. And then I walk in the door, kind of start to wrinkle my nose, and then I'm like, oh, wait a minute, that's actually me. That is why I'm so thankful I discovered Lumi Whole Body Deodorant. This revolutionary product, it was actually invented by an OBGYN who wanted a solution for her patients struggling with private odor. But Lumi doesn't just work, quote, down there. It provides incredible 72-hour protection for your entire body using mandelic acid. I kid you not, this stuff is a game changer. Lumi is safe and effective for pits, for feet, you name it. And as someone who's tried it, I can attest that it seriously works. The fresh scents are just an added bonus. So if you're ready to say goodbye to BO for good, try Lumi Starter Pack. It comes with a solid stick deodorant, cream tube deodorant, two free products of your choice like mini body wash, and deodorant wipes, and free shipping. As a special offer for our listeners, new customers get $5 off a Lumi starter pack with the code GOODLIFE at LumiDeodorant.com. Don't miss your chance to experience the relief of true full body freshness that equates to over 40% off your starter pack when you visit LumiDeodorant.com or just click the link in the show notes and use the code GOODLIFE. What's interesting also is that, you know, a lot of artists feel like for them to have the raw material to create their great work, whether it's writing or painting or photography, they've got to live a raw, tough life. They've got to endure life unfiltered, and which very often involves struggle. And there are a lot of people who feel like, to the extent where, you know, they need to actually, if they don't wander into deep struggle, they need to create it and to really do their best work. And to be exposed to suffering, deep personal suffering, you took an interesting route. You chose for the better part of 10 years, 8 years or so from what I remember, to place yourself in the realm of intense suffering of others.
Yeah, well, I was doing some intense suffering of myself at the time well.
So talk to me about how these play together and how...
Yeah, well, I didn't realize, and this is where we need to be reminded that life really is perfect. You know, I had no idea that when I went to work with dying people that it was actually hooked up to my creative journey. I initially became a carer so that I didn't have to pay rent or a mortgage, so that I could work on my creative journey. And I saw them as two very separate things. One was to earn an income by doing a job with heart, and then the other was my creative side. And so through all of these years of looking after dying people, I was trying to build myself up as a songwriter and working through my own healing. But as the dying people shared their regrets with me and their own pain, I was healing levels of myself that I didn't even know needed healing. And their regrets gave me permission to break free of the boundaries that were holding me, you know, all of the locks I had around myself, because I could see their anguish and their own suffering. And so because I was exposed to these lessons repeatedly over the years, I was able to incorporate them into myself and my own being. And it was just incredible the level of healing I went through with them without even being conscious of it, always conscious of it at the time. Sometimes I was, but at other times I'd look back and realise I'd actually broken through another level of hindrances in myself, all based upon what they'd been sharing with me.
Maybe we should get a little bit of context before, for those who sort of don't know your name or don't know your broader journey. You spent some 8 years or so in palliative care, literally living with people who were in the final stages of their life, first as a companion, and then eventually, you know, even received training in palliative care, which is literally being the person who's with somebody, you know, near around the clock as they're leaving the earth.
Yes.
There's so much to learn and so much to dive into in that experience, but one of the things that comes to me immediately is just the personal toll that it can take on you to move through that process once. You know, you would imagine so many people, it would just be so both profound yet deeply emptying at the same time. But then to actually build a career where you do it over and over and over and over. Talk to me about this a little bit.
I don't think I realized the personal toll it took to the full. I didn't realize to the full extent how much a toll it was taking until after, towards the end of that time, those years. Each time I'd be with someone, I knew that I gave my all, and I felt so blessed and honored to be doing the role. So there was a lot of receiving as well. It wasn't all giving. And because the people I was caring for were dying and they were often fed up and certainly ready to die by the time they died, it made it easier for me to let go because I knew they were free then. Their bodies had stopped causing them pain. And so in that sense, there was always an element of relief for them and happiness for them. And there were always tears for me once they had died, but I deliberately would take a bit of time off, sometimes a few days, sometimes at least a week or 2 weeks even, before I'd take on another client. I was working for an agency, and so I would make myself unavailable immediately after that, because often once it got really close to the person's passing, they didn't want the other carers. They just wanted their main carer, which is the role that I played. And so it was around the clock and really enormous, an enormous demand. But I wanted to be there because I grew to love them. I was with them for some people only a few weeks, but for most of them between 8 and 12 weeks. And so in those couple of months, we got to know each other really well because there's no room for trivia. You're just straight to the core of important things. And so I did grow to love my patients so individually as well as, you know, as my role as their carer. But I did have that break in between, and then I'd go back and do some more, go and look after the next person, and then I'd have a break. And then occasionally I'd just take a few weeks off. And I was also doing a lot of house sitting at the time, so I was relocating regularly. And so if a house sit didn't come up, it often happened that I had nowhere to live after the person died, and so I'd just take a few weeks and go and visit someone and really recharge, and then I'd go back into the city for the next client and the next house sit. And some of the clients I was staying with overnight, but a lot of them I'd just do 12-hour shifts and then go home and come back again. So I'd go home at 8 at night and come back at 8 in the morning, which is pretty much living there anyway.
Right.
And but like I say, in the last week or two, they often wanted me around the clock. So it was an enormous personal toll, but the richness of my experiences kept that subdued until towards the end when I actually started heading to quite a big burnout, understandably.
Yeah, I mean, that's people who do that for life. I'm kind of awestruck by even for the amount of time that you did, yeah.
Yeah, I think it's a great practice of detached compassion.
Yeah.
You have to learn detached compassion, where you certainly feel compassion, but you have to understand that that's their path, and even the suffering at the end is a part of their journey and it brings its own lessons. So, yeah, I think that that's really the only way you can look at that and not take everything on.
Yeah. A friend of mine is a neuroscientist and a physician and a psychiatrist, and he once described to me, he said, you know, what a lot of people don't understand is there's a difference between, and I don't remember if I'm going to get his languaging right, but I believe he called it cognitive empathy and emotional empathy.
Sure, yeah.
And, you know, he said emotional empathy is that you literally feel what the other person is feeling. Cognitive empathy is that you understand cognitively what they're feeling. You may have felt it yourself before, but you don't feel it simultaneously with them. And he said, it's important to understand that distinction and to then be able to cultivate the cognitive and not just the emotional. Because if it's emotional and you feel what they feel almost on the level they feel it, you know, you'll be similarly incapable of action to remove yourself from that. Whereas, you know, on the cognitive side, you can still be in service of.
Mm.
You know, you can feel it. And it sounds like that's a lot of what you're talking about.
I think I grew from one to the other. I certainly started off with the emotional empathy, and I carried it. In some ways, I think that's what made me a good carer, because I could relate to them on such an empathetic level. But at the same time, if I was going to endure and look after myself and truly be a good carer, then I had to learn the other way. And so over the years, I certainly wouldn't say my heart hardened. If anything, my heart opened and softened even more. But yes, I did grow more from the emotional empathy into the cognitive, I think, which is in some ways just another form of detached compassion, another word for detached compassion.
Different language, yes, same experience. Yeah.
Yes.
So through that experience, and you write about one of the people that you cared for, you became very close to, a woman named Grace.
Yeah.
And it sounds like that may have been a bit of sort of like the touch point that really started you thinking about what are some of the big shared lessons through an experience that she shared with you and then a promise that she had you make to her. Would you mind sharing a bit about that?
No, for all of the patients that I looked after, she still remains my favorite, you know, or one of my most favorite. I just loved her dearly. And she had stayed in an incredibly happy marriage, under quite a dictatorship sort of relationship, and then within a few weeks of her husband having to go into a nursing home because he was too frail, she was diagnosed with terminal illness, and so she never actually got to do anything that she wanted in her life. And she had always thought that perhaps once he died she might get to do a bit of travel with her family or whatever. And she was 86, I think, when I met her. Yeah, and her illness was very aggressive as well, and there was just no time. She didn't have even, you know, really a few weeks to go shopping or plan a holiday. It all just happened. By the time the dust settled from her husband going into care, she was not feeling well and she was diagnosed, and it just took hold. And she was in a huge state of anguish for not having had the courage to live how she'd wanted to live. And she'd stayed with the expectations of her generation and never really ventured out of that. And she held my hand so tightly and fiercely one day and made me promise her that I would never do the same, that I would have the courage to live a life true to myself and to do whatever my heart called me to do. And we were both crying at the time, and I promised her that I would. And even without the promise, I would have anyway, because I could feel her intense anguish and heartache. It was just wrenching. And she was just in so much pain and regret for the way she'd chosen to live her life, or not made the choices, you know, and just let life carry her along. That had a huge enough effect on me that I would have honoured that anyway. But then I did also commit to a promise with her. And yeah, there's no way I could have not honoured that promise, because I've learnt through the pain of not only her but including her, of people having that regret of just not honouring what their heart's calling them to do. And I've seen how painful that is, and there's no way I'm going to subject myself to that. So, you know, being shown that firsthand has given me the courage to break through whatever fears and conditioning I had around my own path, to actually be now living an incredibly true calling. That day changed my life forever.
I think in our culture We're so terrified of thinking about death, visiting it in any way, acknowledging that, you know, it is the only thing we know for certain.
Yes.
Death and taxes, right?
In Texas, yeah.
You know, and Steve Jobs' sort of famous Stanford commencement speech is referenced oftentimes that, you know, death is life's greatest creation.
Yes.
Because it reminds you that we are impermanent and the time you spend on the planet it's got to be spent well. But we don't like to go there. We really I don't know whether it feels too morbid to me. I don't like to go there. I don't like to dwell on it. But I do remind myself on a pretty regular basis just of the notion of impermanence, not just of me, but of those around me. Because you just don't know.
Well, you don't. And it's, you know, it's great to face it. It's such a gift to ourselves if we can face the fact that our time here, whether you believe in reincarnation or not, it doesn't matter what your beliefs are beyond. The facts are that our time in this lifetime is finite. You know, it doesn't go forever. And as you say, the same of those we love. And if we can actually recognize that time is a gift, you know, it's such an immense gift, and it's not an ongoing gift. And so from that perspective, if we can face those facts, and for me, you know, being around dying people has made me look at the fact that, sure, I'm definitely going to die. I'm not going to waste a minute of my life doing anything other than honouring where my life's calling. And the beauty is that not only does our heart call us to a place that can offer us immense happiness, it always calls us to serve anyway. But first we need to learn how to honour our own calling, because serving without honouring our own happiness is not balanced. It's not going to bring happiness, and life wants us to be happy. So, you know, if we can face the fact that we are going to die, and that now is so, this moment of now is so important, every moment of now, not just when we've done this or when this happens, but right now, this is a time of possibility, this very ball of time we've got in our hands right at this moment. So, you know, by facing death, it really can be a fabulous tool for living. Yeah.
I want to go into what you also just shared, which is you make a distinction between that which you're called to do and serving or being of service. Talk to me more about that.
Yeah, sorry, I did go.
Just because I think it's interesting, but I think I know what you mean by it, but I just want to make sure. And I think it's a really important distinction.
Okay. Well, you know, a lot of people feel that if they do what their heart want, what they want, which is what, you know, their heart's voice is their calling, and so if they honour that desire, they feel it can be selfish, and it's not at all, because if you truly honour it, each step reveals the next. You don't have to know all the journey, you just, you know, follow the next step and the next step. And as each step reveals itself, the more you're able to honour that voice of that calling from your heart, the more it then calls you to serve anyway, because our happiness ultimately lies in helping others. And we may not go into it with such noble intentions. We may just go into it thinking, well, I've always wanted to travel to this country. I can't shake it. There's just something about this country that makes me want to go there. And so eventually you go there, and whatever feeling that's going to give you, that's going to lead you to the next step. It may help you realize, okay, you know, I've got that out of my system. Now I'm free to actually do this. Or it might be what I've learned about myself through doing this trip is going to lead me to the next step. Ultimately, it doesn't matter. Ultimately, every step you take in honouring your heart's voice in some way or another will pull you to serving other people. But if you just have a call to serve other people, but you suppress all the desires in yourself, then you will burn out. I did that. I say this from first-hand experience, because I was serving without honouring all of my own needs. I was trying to, and eventually, as I said earlier, I did. But yeah, it's just one step at a time. Follow your heart's voice, and it will call us to serve, because that's the way the world works. We're here to serve, and And in doing so, we become our best self, and that's what life wants from all of us. But we can only become our best self by honoring our heart and serving.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Mom deserves better than a drugstore card. This Mother's Day, surprise her with a truly special personalized card from Moonpig. Add your favorite photos, a heartfelt message, and we'll even mail it for you the same day, all for just $5. From mom to grandma, we have something to celebrate every mom in your life. Every mom deserves a Moonpig card. Get 50% off your first card at Moonpig.com.
Moonpig.com.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary, not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com. The number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.
So at some point, your creative world and your service heart also merge, and you're living a fairly private life, serving these, you know, people who are in their final parts of life, also as much as you can with whatever you have available, trying to honor that artist in you, that, you know, inner creator, the writer and the photographer. And it seems like those two worlds meet when you decide to sit down one day and write about these patterns that you're seeing, the shared regrets of the people who you've served for so long, which then, you know, you shared online and it massively exploded into the world's consciousness as nearly top five regrets of the dying. What was it that moved you at that moment in time to say, I've seen this process enough times, I've seen the pattern enough times, that I need to sit down and use my writer's mind and my writer's voice to put these together and to turn around and share them?
It was life signposts, really. I had just finished working with dying people. I wanted to work where there was some hope. And so through one of the friends from one of my dying patients, I was able to secure funding to set up a program to teach songwriting in a women's jail, and which was, you know, completely different, but I thought at least I was earning doing something creative. That was the next step. And so I'd just begun teaching in a jail, and I was playing as a singer-songwriter by then, and I was playing at a festival, and an editor of a music magazine said, write me a story about teaching in the jail and we'll publish it. And so when I wrote this article, I thought to myself, why aren't I writing more? I love writing. You know, this is crazy. Why? I've always written as a child, and why aren't I writing? I was a songwriter. I was writing quotes that went with photos, but I'd never seen myself actually as a writer until that moment. And so I thought, oh, well, I'll start a blog. And so I put that article about the songwriting on as my first blog, and then took a little while to set the blog up over a couple of weeks. And then I just thought, well, what do I write about now? And I was sitting outside on the veranda one day. I was living in the Blue Mountains at the time, just west of Sydney, and I thought, what am I going to write about? And I just got very clear guidance, write what you know. And I thought, okay, well, what I know is the effects that dying people have had on me. And that's how it actually came up. It wasn't that every person had regrets. A lot did, more did than didn't. But it was that the regrets that dying people had shared with me were what had the most profound effect on me for all of those years of looking after them. So there was no consciousness at all of how the article would be received. It was just, okay, well, I'll write a blog. And when I wrote down all the regrets, and I'd also written a journal for all of those years while I was looking after the dying people. So I had, you know, books and books of things they'd shared with me. And so I just sat down and wrote about their regrets, because that is what had affected me most personally. And that was it. And I posted it, thought no more of it, got on with teaching and burned out a bit. And then about 6 months later, the blog took off, and the rest is history.
and just for those who haven't read, I've just printed out quickly what those five were, just so that I can share with people. Should have brought my reading glasses. The first was what we had actually just spoken about, which is, I wish I'd had the courage to live a life true to myself, not the life others expected of me. The second was, I wish I hadn't worked so hard. The third, I wish I'd had the courage to express my feelings. And the fourth is, I wish I had stayed in touch with my friends. And finally, I wish I had let myself be happier. Rather than sort of going into each one of those independently, because I'm guessing at this point you've probably had that conversation to death. I've been on the other side of the microphone sometimes. And I think, you know, each of the five are beautiful. They're fairly self-evident, and there are gorgeous stories around each of them. I'm curious. I love the fact that you wrote this and you put it out there also, and then it just sat.
Yes.
You know, and then just sort of had you largely just forgotten about it, and then out of the ether?
There were a couple of people in the first few months found it and asked could they share it, and I said yes, as long as it comes back with a link to my blog. And I just kept writing. I think a lot of things in life, or everything in life, comes down to readiness and timing. At the time that I wrote it, I wasn't ready for the success that it was going to offer me. So after I looked after taught in the jail, coming from dying people to teaching in a jail, I then burnt out and went through a period of suicidal depression. So it was a huge burnout. And so it was only after I was pulling myself through that, and in that time I moved to a farm and lived by a creek and really dropped out for a while. So it was only as I was coming through that, and I'd been writing a blog all the way through, and I was a lot clearer in my writing journey then, and that's when it took off. And so I had to go through that catharsis of healing before I was ready to deal with the level of exposure that the article was going to bring my way. I didn't have any more to give, and had the article taken off when I first wrote it, it would have killed me emotionally, because I just didn't have anything else to give. And in that 6 months of burning out, I wasn't capable of doing anything but learning how to nurture myself instead of giving to everyone else. I had to learn to give to myself, and fight all those parts of myself that didn't know how to receive. And so it was only once I reached that place of readiness to receive and to be able to accept that life was calling me into a more public role, that then the doors opened. And it was pretty much as soon as I said, okay, life, I'll do, you know, whatever you want, God, just I'll be your instrument, and whatever message I'm meant to share with the world, bring it through, let's do it. And little did I know, it had already been brought through. And it was almost instant after that, the article took off, and took off
in a huge way.
It had something like 8 million views in the first 3 years. So it was,
wow,
yeah, which is astonishing.
It's surreal, right?
Yes.
Are you open, because I'm curious what you said, you moved into a place during those 6 months of suicidal, I guess what they would now call suicidal ideation and deep depression. Because it seemed like you had already made a decision to leave the thing that had really been emptying you and try and transition to.
Yes.
What was it that kept deepening you into that place then? And how did you move out of it? What made the transition?
I think that I had so much pain. I was still carrying burdens of pain from my past. I'd been a black sheep, and I had to give myself permission to be the black sheep.
Tell me what you mean by black sheep.
It might be an Australian thing, like the black sheep in the family, the one that stands out amongst everyone else, that you're different to the rest of the clan. And so, you know, I was the artist in the family. I was the nomadic one. I wasn't settled. I was restless. I was all of these things, which in hindsight now, it's like, as who I am now, it's like, great, fantastic, you know. But back then, I was so shaped by the expectations of others and the fear of more ridicule if I dared to step out and be who I was, that I had to be completely, I had to be shattered completely to really get rid of that shell around me and to let my true light shine. And so I think that's why I did slide down that far, even though I thought I was already moving forward by teaching in the jail. It was only, just a temporary medication on top in a way. I had to go to the bottom to come to the top, you know, to start a brand new path. And I did. And what I did through that time was I wrote a lot. I hung out with the seasons. You know, I had a creek flowing. I was on a 2,000-acre farm, found an amazing little cottage to rent. And I just moved with the days and the rhythm of nature. I cried solidly, you know, I think. Well, with depression, you know, I didn't realise I had it. I just had a lot of tears, and then I went and sought help. And my counsellor said to me, "You've obviously got depression." And I'm like, "I haven't got depression," you know. And I'm crying, and I said, "Oh, the doctor reckons I've got depression. I don't have depression." And she's saying, "Well, is this happening? Is this happening?" Do you? And I said, "Yep. You know, I don't have the energy to give anymore. I just can't be bothered. All I want to do is cry. I don't want to eat properly. Whatever. I wake up crying." I mean, that was the hardest bit, that I would, before I'd even had a conscious thought for the day, I would already be crying. The minute I woke up, I was crying. And that was, you know, that's healing from a level well beyond your consciousness. It was such a cleansing time. And, yeah, and I just worked my way through it and lovingly looked after myself in a way that I had looked after my patients. I started nurturing myself with that same level of tenderness and gentleness. And I swam a lot. I found an ocean pool, you know, a pool with ocean water coming in. And I went there a lot and swam and walked. And, yeah, and then once I was ready to get back into life, I started playing music at children's preschools instead of pubs and clubs to a whole different audience.
In prisons.
Yeah, in prison, that's right. So yeah. I just decided to be around children and just did much more positive things, and then my blog took off. I ended up writing a book, and went from there.
Yeah, it's amazing the way that when I'm not an overly metaphysical person, but when you hear certain things, you're sort of like, where the timing is just,
yes,
too much. Yeah, you're kind of like, okay, maybe there's something bigger going on.
Sure.
At the moment, when you decided when that took off, was that also something where you wanted to really spend a lot of time now writing and creating and make that the focus? Mm-hmm.
I just wanted to love my work more than anything. That was the driving force. I just wanted to love my work. And I loved the idea of working from home. That was a big part of it too, because home was becoming a stronger and stronger desire after so many years of moving around. I think it was just a fact of loving my work. But what you said about timing is crucial. You know, I wasn't ready before. And as that took off, I then wrote my book. I released it independently. And I ended up meeting a partner and having falling pregnant. The second month we tried, I was 44 at the time. So it was a whole life-changing time. But in the month or two before my baby was due, my independently published book, Five Regrets of the Dying, had taken off like crazy. And then I was doing, the night before she was born, it took off to a whole new level the few days before she was born. And so I was doing interviews from my hospital bed while I was in labour, like all around the world, and I'm doing like email ones with the phone, you know, all of it. And I turned off my phone at 11 o'clock at night, and I was in labour, and there were still more interviews to do. And I was so sad, because I'd worked for 14 years as an artist to start making a living, and finally I was given that opportunity. But now I was a mum, I was about to become a mother, and that was way more important to me, and I wanted to be present with that. So the night before my daughter was born, I just sent out a huge, well, it wasn't even a prayer, it was a demand, really. It was just like, I need help now, this is too much, I can't do this on my own anymore. And then my daughter was born the next morning while the midwife's getting me ready, while I'd finished off the last couple of email interviews. Well, it was just awful. It was just the whole trying to serve two masters of career and motherhood. And then I gave birth to my baby, my darling little girl, Eleanor. And within 24 hours of her being born, Hay House rang me up out of the blue, who was my dream publishing house, and offered me a contract, an international publishing contract. And my book is now in 27 languages. And so I was in hospital for 5 days. And so by the time I left the hospital, I had a baby and a publishing contract.
Yeah, you had two babies.
I did. They're both birthing. And, you know, again, it comes down to that readiness and timing, because I was doing it all on my own and not realising how much I needed help as my work was growing, gaining momentum. And then finally, you know, it got to that point where the pain of having too much going on was, you know, where I've just said, no more, I need help here. And I was never that determined prior to that. I thought I wouldn't mind help, but finally I reached that crucial point where I just said, no, enough, I'm not doing this anymore. And so, yeah, what you say about timing, yeah.
So here's where my mind is going with this. I mean, other than the visualization of you being in labor, sort of on the phone doing interviews.
It was shocking. It was awful. It's just,
here's the question that comes to me, which is, because it's been a pattern a couple of times with you, and it's also, it's been a pattern through, you know, the so many of the conversations I've been blessed to have with incredible people over the years now. And the question has stayed with me, and it's coming up again in this conversation with you, which is, do we have to reach that point in order to make the decisions and take the actions that allow us to live from that moment forward differently, and or for the universe to rise up and support our desire to do so? Or can we somehow move through those moments with more ease and still end up in the same place? I'm curious what you think about that.
Love that question. We don't have to go through all that pain, but what we do have to go through is a place that brings us to that realization, so that I don't go through that pain now to make such decisions. I know that I have to honour myself, and in doing so, things just come to me faster and faster by honouring, you know, myself without all that pain of reaching breaking point. But I had to go through an awful lot to reach that point in myself where I give myself that permission. And so, yeah, we don't have to go through the suffering and the pain to make those decisions. But, you know, I'm not going to say we have to go through the suffering and pain to reach that place, but I am going to say that. Like, we have to go through whatever our growth is to reach a place where we give ourselves permission. Yeah. Does that make sense?
Yeah. I mean, it's funny. You used the word earlier in our conversation, shattered.
Yes.
And that exact word has come up many times in conversation. And it's almost like the pieces have to come apart. Like you can't reassemble a puzzle that's already whole. Yeah. Even if it's whole and the picture on the puzzle is one of torment. You know, like you can't take that puzzle and move the pieces around to create a picture of joy or grace or ease when the puzzle remains whole. It's like you have to shatter the pieces, and all of them have to end up on the floor. You can't just have one.
Yes.
You know, so I guess, but then the question is, you know, it's like the shattering, the breaking apart of the current reality has to happen. But then the question is, can you do that through, you know, what is the inciting incident, and does it have to be one of great pain, or can it be one where in some way you experience it more gently? You know, I don't know the answer to that.
Well,
I've seen a lot of examples of pain.
Yes, the pain all comes down to the willingness, you know, the resistance to surrendering.
Yeah.
You know, that's all it is. And, you know, when we can reach that place where we are willing to surrender, and most of us only reach it through pain, then there's no resistance, because, you know, you're fine. If you've surrendered, you go with it, and you give yourself permission and you trust and get on with it. But until we reach that place where we're resistant to surrendering to our better self, you know, which is the bottom line, then there's always going to be pain. So perhaps that shattering is an essential part of it, of the journey, unfortunately. Well, fortunately.
Yeah. Yes. Maybe the shattering is our surrender to the truth of uncertainty.
Absolutely, and we think we've got it all worked out before that, perhaps, but the uncertainty is where the magic happens.
Yeah, so agree. It's where possibility lies.
Oh, it's just
terrifying, but it's where possibility lies.
Yeah. When I think of how I live now and how many blessings flow so easily and naturally to me without much conscious thought at all, it just makes me immensely grateful that I face going through that time, you know, and let myself be shattered. Yeah.
Which is a beautiful place, I think, for us to come full circle. So the name of this is Good Life Project. So if I offer that phrase out to you, to live a good life, what comes up?
Just be happy. Just be happy. Give yourself permission to be happy. Just be happy. Yeah. I could go on and on about happiness, but that's the bottom line. Make a choice as every day as best you can towards happiness. Yeah.
Thank you.
My pleasure.
Thank you so much for listening, and thanks also to our fantastic sponsors who help make this show possible. You can check them out in the links we have included in today's show notes. And while you're at it, if you've ever asked yourself, what should I do with my life? We have created a really cool online assessment that will help you discover the source code for the work that you're here to do. You can find it at sparkatype.com. That's sparkatype.com, or just click the link in the show notes. And of course, if you haven't already done so, be sure to click on the subscribe button in your listening app so you never miss an episode. And then share the love. If there's something that you've heard in this episode that you would love to turn into a conversation, share it with people and have that conversation. Because when ideas become conversations that lead to action, that's when real change takes hold. See you next time.